As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
There goes the fly ball towards left field. Going back fast is Kennedy. Kennedy gets there, and he takes it. And the Cleveland Indians are the world champions of 1948. And they are leaping joyously as they go off the field. Din is being mobbed as our Rube Boudreau and out in center field, Tucker and Kennedy come running in arm in arm.
Little tap up in the air, third base side, waiting is Tomey. Foul territory, the game is over. And the Indians have won the divisional title. Indian fans have waited 41 years. And now they can really cheer.
Now the pitch.
Swung on, line to deep left field. It is gone! You should see the celebration out of the Indians' third base dugout, Rajay Davis, a bullet, two-run homer down the left field line, clearing the 19-foot wall. We are tied at six.
This is Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive. A regular look back at professional baseball history in Cleveland since 1901 and beyond. Now, here's your host, Indians team historian, Jeremy Fedor.
Hello, Tribe fans, and welcome back to another episode of Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive. I am your host, Cleveland Indians team historian, Jeremy Fedor. We have an exciting episode for you this week. We're going to talk about Ray Chapman, and in this podcast, I was fortunate enough to interview Mike Sowell, and if the name sounds familiar, he is the author of The Pitch That Killed, which is, for me, you know, one of my top baseball books. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, I'd say pick it up. It's the story of Ray Chapman and Carl Mays and that fateful day at the Polo Grounds in 1920, and he does a great job chronicling everything that led up to that moment and the events after. So throughout this podcast, you're going to hear parts of my conversation with Mike. I'm also very excited to do an episode on Ray Chapman. There's a certain, I think, cliff notes of Cleveland Indians history that if you're not into baseball history as much as, say, I am or any hardcore baseball aficionado, I guess, a lot of people still know Ray Chapman. And like I said, the cliff notes of Cleveland Indians history, named after Nat Blashway for a time, then the 20s, they won a World Series, Ray Chapman gets hit, then fans will know 48 and Feller, as well as Larry Doby, then with Frank Robinson, and then the 90s. And that's, again, the cliff note version of Cleveland Indians history, but Ray Chapman holds such a monumental part in that history. And unfortunately, it's not necessarily for his play. Most people remember him because he was killed. He was the last professional baseball player to be killed on the field as a result of a pitched ball. So that is why Ray gets remembered. And he actually was a fan favorite of the time. People loved him, and it was just absolutely devastating when this event happened. So hopefully we can shed some light on Ray before the accident and bring some more appreciation as we get close to that 100-year anniversary of his death. There's an interest in Ray, too. I think every year I at least get one or two requests, whether they're from a National History Day student or someone asking questions about Ray and the situation. So there definitely is an interest. If you go to Lakeview Cemetery, there's always baseballs or hats or mementos left at his gravesite, and usually a local paper will cover that and have a photo of it, or it will pop up on Twitter on the anniversary. So it's one of those baseball events that is still remembered, and fans still remember that. It's such a big piece of baseball trivia. And interestingly enough, that's kind of what led Mike Soule to write about Ray. One of the questions I asked him was, you're not a Clevelander, not necessarily, at least at the time, wasn't an Indians fan. What kind of got you interested in the Ray Chapman story? And this was his response.
I got interested in baseball when I was 10 years old, and that was back in the late 1950s. So I read a lot of baseball books, and one of them was a book about strange sports incidents. And they had a section or a page on the Ray Chapman beating. And of course, it was filled with incorrect information about how the fatal beating took place. The second inning, he was the second batter. There were two outs. The count was 2-2, and none of that was true. But it fascinated me about Ray Chapman being the only player ever killed in a game.
I think that's a great example, too, of how people still come across the story of Ray Chapman. It's just in these footnotes or these random did-you-know sections of newspapers or books or tweets or wherever. And, there's such a prevalence of that stuff floating around with misinformation. And to Mike's credit, he was a sports writer and decided he wanted to get into that topic, and it hadn't been really deeply researched yet. And again, bigger picture, that's what's kind of beautiful about the Indians' history, is that there's so much of our history that hasn't been written about or looked into. Yeah, the 2018, the 48, and the 90s get a lot of attention, but there's such a deep well of history, and we're just starting to uncover a lot of it. Now, anyone can go to Baseball Reference and see, Ray was born in 1891 in Kentucky, or, how many hits he had as a rookie. But I was kind of interested in anything Mike found doing his research so long ago about Ray's formative years growing up.
But I did travel to his home in where he grew up in Kentucky, and mostly he grew up in Herron, Illinois. His father was a coal miner. He came from Ray came from a very poor family, but he was always a star athlete and a baseball player. And, to read about those early years, it required going to those towns and reading the archives of the old newspapers. But, Ray was always a outstanding ball player, very fast, very flashy fielder, but most of all, what everyone commented on was his great personality and his joy at living. He was kind of the guy who one manager said, even if he couldn't play, he would have been valuable as a cheerleader on the bench. And that held true until he got to Cleveland.
Ray's name starts to pop up in the Cleveland Plain Dealer around August of 1912. It's mentioned that the Naps were going to get shortstop Ray Chapman from Toledo and maybe another player, but it mentioned that Ray was not a star, but a fairly consistent man in his department. Next day, it mentions that he actually had a pretty good year so far. He has batting .329 with 92 runs scored and 45 bases stolen. He was the star of his league. By December, the newspaper was saying that both him and Doc Johnston were making good in a Cleveland uniform. We mentioned Doc in a previous episode as one of the guys on that 1920 team as well. as Mike said, Ray was a guy that he was easy to get along with, and people loved him, and he just had one of those personalities. And you see that in the newspaper articles. One from 1913 mentioned how he was having a rough day in the field, but the fans were still giving him support. And he said, had the fans got after me today, I don't know where I would have thrown the ball, but with them helping me, I just had to settle down. And the title of the article was, Fans Are Chapman's Friends for Life Just Because They Cheered Him Along. So he had a personality that was the defining aspect of him, that he was just a likable guy, and now we call a good clubhouse guy. Here, Mike elaborates.
He was probably the single most popular baseball player among other players at that time. He didn't have any enemies, opponents, teammates. They all loved him. He was always in a good mood. He was the type of person who, when he came into a room, he kind of lightened it up, and everyone's attention was drawn to him. He was really talented. He had a great voice. He was the guy who led the team in singing, and just kind of a cheerleader. And he was also such a flashy fielding player that he was probably like the Ozzie Smith of his day as far as his fielding. Made a lot of spectacular plays. The fans loved him. He was the best bunter in baseball, and he still holds the record for the most sacrifice hits.
1912, Ray plays 31 games, but as the seasons progress, he puts more and more time. He has a few injuries here and there. He breaks his ankle or his leg sliding 1 year. But again, a fairly consistent and sturdy ball player. And time goes on. He's developing a life for himself. He ends up meeting his wife, Kathleen Daly. Her father was, I believe, president of East Ohio Gas. So Ray was possibly thinking of life after baseball, maybe even as early as that 1920 season. He's reaching that age, he's 29 that year, of how many more years of baseball do you have left? That kind of adds to the tragic tale of all this. He recently got married and his wife becomes pregnant. So he's got this great life going for him. But as we all know, the story does not take a happy turn. And here is Mike's take on Ray Chapman.
As most people who follow that or read about that Indians team know, that there was some talk that he was going to retire at the end of that season. He had, from this early beginning as the son of a coal miner, he had risen into Cleveland high society by marrying Kathleen Daly, who was the daughter of one of the wealthiest businessmen in Cleveland. So, and at the time, the 1920 season, Kathleen had gotten pregnant, and Mr. Daly was building a house for the newlyweds. And so it was a great period or a great time in Ray Chapman's life. And, so much was coming together for him. And all of this before that tragic ending out on the ballpark in New York.
And two things about that. One, if you're interested, the house that Ray's father-in-law was building for them actually ended up being built. It still stands today. It's near Lakeview Cemetery, which is kind of ironic, I guess, considering that's where Ray ends up being buried. But as something that I'm interested in for my job, it's finding these connections to our past, and the house that Ray and his wife and, that happily ever after was supposed to happen is still standing, and you can actually go see it. But another point is, and this is what I asked Mike, is were these stories of Ray wanting to retire after 1920 true? I mean, was it something that was going on in the papers? Obviously, hindsight's 2020, so you could make the story a lot sadder when you interject the fact that, hey, he was going to retire. And obviously he was passed away by then, so you couldn't really ask him if that was true. So this is Mike's response to that question.
There, it was in the newspapers. There actually was a feeling that he might retire, but I don't think he would have. I mean, he was at the peak of his career. He was having a great season. Bill James has speculated on what might have happened had Chapman lived, had this beaning not happened, and that Ray was the best of all of those great shortstops, you know, so, a few of whom ended up in the Hall of Fame. And it's pretty definite that Ray Chapman would be in the Hall of Fame today had it not been this tragic ending. The other thing is that he was a good hitter. He was the fastest player in the league, or actually the fastest in baseball back then. And he was in the prime of his career, and 1920 was when the lively ball era started, where the, you know, the batting statistics took a big jump forward. So Ray would have benefited from that, and his record would have been outstanding, you know, certainly better than his contemporaries at shortstop. So it's hard to say definitely that he would have kept playing or he would have retired, but I lean toward the fact that he was not going to retire after Cleveland winning its first pennant and championship.
And with that, we're going to move on to the actual game at the Polo Grounds in August, and I'll let Mike set the stage for that.
Well, it was a critical game. The Indians had been in a kind of a three-team race. The Chicago White Sox, basically the Black Sox team from 1919 was still together, and they had a great team. And the Yankees, with Babe Ruth now on the team, they'd gotten him from the Red Sox in 1918. So it was a three-team race, but the Indians at one point had a big lead in midsummer, and then they hit a bad stretch. It became a tight three-team race, and the Indians went to New York for a critical road trip that would start with a series against the Yankees. So it was a big game, and it was the first game of the series. It was August 16, and by chance, Carl Mays, the Yankees manager, Miller Huggins, revised his pitching order to get Mays to pitch the opening game of the series, you know, with so much at stake. And coincidentally, Mays also was going for his 100th win that day.
And that game featured Stan Kovaleski pitching for the Indians. And between Kovaleski and Mays, it was a pretty tight game. The Tribe was up 3-0 going into the top of the fifth with Ray Chapman coming to bat. Ray had gone over 2 so far in the game. He had 2 outs, both by bunt, so wasn't having a great game at bat. Mike points out another fascinating coincidence regarding Chapman that took place on that day.
And another coincidence was the day of the game was a book on baseball instruction for young players, you know, for children had come out, and the author had chosen Ray Chapman as the ideal batter in his batting stance because it enabled him to stay at the plate and wait for a while, you know, wait on the pitch. You know, he was able to get out of the way of a pitch. So it was speculated he would be the hardest player to be hit by pitch in the game.
And the other half of this combination is Carl Mays, the pitcher for the Yankees. Mike describes the way that Mays pitched was this really low submarine style pitching, but with power behind it. And here is Mike's description of Carl.
A submarine pitcher. So he threw underhanded. He had an arm injury in the minor leagues. And although, you know, the submarine pitchers since then are the underhand pitchers, usually were soft pitchers, but Mays was a power pitcher still. Bill James said he was the only one of the underhand pitchers in baseball history who was still a power pitcher. And Mays, when he would pitch, his pitching hand, he was right-handed, and his knuckles would scrape the ground. That's how far down he was getting when he would throw. So the ball was coming in from an unusual angle, And Mays was able to put a lot of movement on the ball, so it took a lot of unusual twists and turns.
And there's a perfect storm, so to speak. You have Chapman up, kind of crowding the plate. You have a baseball that hasn't been rotated out like we have today, and it's a little bit of an overcast day, so it's a little hard to pick up on the ball. And you have this pitcher that's just got a unique delivery that it's not something you see every day. So perhaps the stars were aligned against Ray Chapman for that situation. And here's Mike Sowell's description of the events of that day.
But on this day, when Chapman came up, he was in the batter's box. Mays was thinking he was going to try to bunt. So Mays was throwing inside. But according to the catcher, Muddy Rule, this particular pitch came in and it was taking unusual turns. But Muddy Rule said that the pitch was in the strike zone. It would have been a called strike. But Chapman, as he always did, he was crowding the plate, and he had, according to Rule, Chapman's head was actually leaning over the plate in the strike zone. Of course, now that can be disputed, but the pitch came in, and it was inside, or it was coming toward Chapman's head, and for some reason, he froze. He didn't make any movement to get out of the way of the pitch. And a former Cleveland ball player who had been seriously beamed a few years earlier had talked about that experience, and he said that on those occasions, you see the ball coming, you know it's going to hit you, but you're fascinated by it, and it's like a snake, a deadly snake about to strike you, and you're just paralyzed. You see what's going to happen, but you can't move to prevent it. So that was what some people thought happened to Chapman. Others speculate he lost the ball in the, you know, the background, that he couldn't pick up the ball very well. But whatever, the ball did hit him in the head. It hit with such force that there was a loud crack, and the ball bounded back out to the pitcher's mound. So Mays, thinking it was that the ball had hit the bat, you know, fielded it and threw to first base. Wally Pipp was playing first base for the Yankees. He turned to throw the ball around the infield, and then they noticed that something was wrong, and Chapman had fought, you know, was sinking to the ground at the plate. So that's how the beaning came about.
After Chapman's hit, players come to his side. They get him up and try to walk him off the field and get out to the clubhouse. And Ray is a little bit, he's a little bit with it. He can get up and walk a little bit, but then he just collapses, and the players have to carry him back to the clubhouse. And, you know, it's one of those situations where you hold your breath and you hope the best. And later on, Tris Speaker, who a close friend of Ray Chapman, mentions his, he took a ball to the head. We mentioned that in the previous podcast during the World War I episode, where he wasn't able to participate in the drilling on the field because he still had headaches. So at this point, no one knows, you know, what's going to happen to Ray Chapman. They just know it's serious and it doesn't look good. And to kind of sidebar a little bit, there's this ball at a museum down in Florida that they claim to be the death ball of Ray Chapman. And again, as one of the interests of what I do, the memorabilia and the material culture of Cleveland Indians history, it's such a unique story that is attached to this ball that in the museum world, we call it provenance, the ownership of an item. So think about authentics and the authentication. If a ball goes into a stands, for example, as Estribel Cabrera threw the unassisted triple play ball into the stands after he had made the triple play, well, once it's in the stands, you can't authenticate it. If they throw it to someone who happened to have another ball in their pocket, you know, they could pull the other ball out and say, this is the ball, and it's just, you never know. So the story with Chapman's ball is that later on, there's a gentleman who has the ball, and he said, well, Charlie Jameson told me that players were crowded around Chapman, and they kept stepping on the ball, so Jameson put it in his back pocket, and long story short, threw it in his bag, and after the season was over, you know, I was like, oh, this is the ball, and Then he ended up saving it. But as he got older, he's like, I don't want this. Gave it to a sports writer who happened to be a – or actually it was to a youth baseball coach. And as the story goes, the coach needed a ball for his batting practice with the kids. So they pulled it out of his glove compartment where it lived. And as they were taking like grounders, the ball – the first ball hit, bounces a few times and hits the kid and, you know, breaks his – face or something along that nature, and this ball is cursed, so it's passed on to someone else. And you know, it's such a far-fetched tale. And again, no one knew that Chapman was going to die, so why would Jameson have held on to the ball? And the newspapers don't corroborate that. And you know, Mike and I talked a little bit about that, and you know, both kind of on the same page of it's a far-fetched story, but you know, it'd be nearly impossible to prove that that ball that is called the Chapman death ball is actually the ball, just because there's so many strikes against it.
Here, Mike goes into a little more detail.
But the reality is that, and this was covered in detail in the newspapers after that game, but the reality is that the ball hit the, I mean, after it hit Chapman, it went all the way back to the mound. And that was, I mean, all the sports I saw, it was very obvious, and it was thrown to Wally Pipp at first base. So when Mays and Pipp realized what had happened, then Mays started complaining to the umpire that he should have thrown the ball out of play, and he was showing the ball to the umpire to show that it was too scuffed up to stay in the game. And he was essentially trying to put blame on the home plate umpire, Tommy Connolly, that it was his fault Chapman was beamed.
Going back to the clubhouse, apparently Ray may have been somewhat conscious. He was supposedly asking for his wedding ring or trying to talk to some of his teammates. And again, here's Mike.
Well, according to the coverage that I had and everything I found, they got him to the clubhouse and they had him lying on a table, and they called an ambulance. So the ambulance was coming and he was conscious and he was trying to speak, but he couldn't. And he saw the team trainer and he motioned him over and he kept pointing at his ring. Chapman kept pointing at his own ring finger. And He before every game, he would give his wedding ring to the trainer to keep during the game. And he was motioning to the trainer because he wanted the wedding ring back. He wanted it put on his finger. So Percy Smallwood, the trainer, placed the ring back on his finger, and that brought Chapman a lot of relief. And he was, according to, I believe it was Jack Graney, Chapman was able to whisper to him that, you know, don't tell Kathleen, but if you do, tell her I'm all right. You know, he didn't want his wife to know about he'd been seriously hurt. So I think he was conscious for a little while, but then he was unconscious on the ambulance ride. According to there's a former ball player who accompanied him to the hospital, I guess when they were they roll him into the hospital, and he was on an elevator, and he said something about there was not enough air in there, and so the ball player started fanning him to keep him cool, but apparently Chapman was somewhat conscious, but then he became unconscious again, and he never regained consciousness, and he died shortly after there was surgery on his skull to relieve the pressure from the brain swelling up, and he died overnight.
During this time, Chapman's wife, the pregnant Kathleen, is aware of what's going on, but not sure of the seriousness. So she hops on a train and goes to New York, only to realize when she gets there that Ray had passed away. If you look at the plane dealer from that period, from those days, it's just, you know, testaments to Ray Chapman and what a guy he was. Like Mike mentioned earlier, like I mentioned earlier, that he was just such a nice person that fans loved him, that players loved him. He was a joy to be around and just a great person. So there was this tremendous amount of sadness and an outpouring of grief. And players, again, it goes to that whole question of, was Mays trying to hit Chapman or was trying to brush him off? You know, Mays wasn't well liked by a lot of his teammates and even other players in baseball. So you have one of the nicest guys in baseball being hit by one of the most reviled guys in baseball. And it kind of can lead to a brouhaha, so to speak. And they went to Tris right away and said, "Do you think he tried to hit him?" And Tris said, "No, I don't think he did." And later on, there's players that on the Indian team that never forgave Mays, that, you know, always held that he was headhunting and it was his fault for killing Ray. So it actually led to other teams revolting as well, not wanting to play until Carl Mays was tossed out of the league. And again, the story on this is much deeper. So if you want to get into this part, again, it's in Mike's book. I highly suggest picking that up. And the house the Dailies lived in, Chapman's body was brought back from New York, and it actually went to the house. The house no longer stands. Unfortunately, it's a vacant lot, but they were going to have the funeral, I believe, at St. Philomena at first, but moved it to St. John on East 9th just because it was a much larger venue for the funeral, because everyone wanted to be there. And again, it was standing room only. After the funeral, it led to Lakeview Cemetery, where Ray is buried today. But there's an interesting discussion there, is that Tris Speaker and Jack Graney both didn't make it to the funeral. In a previous interview with Scott Longer, author of the book on the 1920 Indians, we spoke about this situation, and apparently there was the newspaper said that the players were overwhelmed and they actually couldn't make it to the funeral. Jack Graney had to get out of town. But there actually was most likely a fight between Speaker Steve O'Neill and Jack Graney regarding the possibility that Ray was going to convert to Catholicism, and Speaker supposedly having this anti-Catholic feeling. So more or less it came to blows. However, the newspaper never ran with that. They just kind of, like I said, the players were overwhelmed. And Scott does a great job digging into that and believes wholeheartedly that that fight did happen. I believe he said he mentioned he talked to Steve O'Neill's granddaughter, who was aware of it. And here we have Mike was actually able to speak with someone who was there, and he had Wambi's take on it.
Well, according to Bill Wamsgans, who was the only player on that team still living when I was researching and writing the book, and so I was able to talk to him, and he said that, you know, that they put out the story about them being too overcome, and they tried to deny the fight, but I think Wamsgans' exact words were, "We all knew damn well that they did fight." So I believe that is true, that Speaker and Graney fought, and that's why they were unable to attend the funeral, because they did some damage to each other.
There's the unanswered question, too, of why was Ray buried at Lakeview Cemetery? You know, there's a family cemetery plot down south where his family's buried, or Daly family have plots in Calvary Cemetery, which is a Catholic cemetery. So Ray is buried in Lakeview and all by himself, because the tragedy of the Chapman family, you know, continues not long after Ray dies. Is his wife remarries. She has the baby, Ray's daughter, and moves out to California, but eventually just is so distraught over everything years later, commits suicide. Ray's daughter then is sent back to Cleveland, where she dies of sickness. I think she was 8 years old or somewhere around there. So both of them are buried in Calvary Cemetery away from Ray. fairly quickly after Ray's passing, these groups come together to raise money to build a memorial or monument in Ray's memory. So if you've ever been to our Heritage Park, you'll notice this tablet on the bottom floor of our Heritage Park of Ray Chapman. And that was created within the year of his passing. So you can go out to Heritage Park and, you know, check that out, and you could touch it if you like. It used to hang in League Park, and then when they moved to Municipal Stadium, it supposedly was on one of the walls by one of the ticketing offices. I've never found a picture of it. I would love to actually find a picture of it hanging at Municipal Stadium. But as the story goes, when we moved to Progressive Field, it got lost in one of the mechanical areas where they store everything, and was discovered in the late 2000s and refurbished and put back up. So, you know, his memory is still with Cleveland fans, and it's one of the, I think, most visited grave sites in Lakeview. I mean, I have no statistics to back it up, but there's always baseballs and hats and at his grave site. And that's the I guess Cliff Note version of the Ray Chapman incident. As I mentioned before, great book, The Pitch That Killed, real deep dive. It's been around for, I think it's been 30 years. And Scott's book also goes into great detail about the incident. But again, Ray is still remembered in Cleveland. We're going to get to the 100th anniversary in a couple months. So I'd, hopefully if you have a chance, if you're getting a little stir crazy, you can take a trip to Lakeview and check out Ray's tombstone. And that wraps up this episode of Our Tribe History presented by Progressive. I hope you'll join us next week when we start to look at the nuts and bolts of that 1920 season leading into the World Series.
You've been listening to Our Tribe History presented by Progressive with your host, Indians team historian Jeremy Fedor.